Well, hello, it's Sean Defoe here. Long time no talk. In fact, the first time in almost 8 months that you've heard me and not one of my lovely colleagues who have ably kept the podcast on the road. So you're probably wondering, just where have I been? Well, let me explain.
Let me explain with Sean Defoe, a News Talk original.
It does feel good to say that again, I have to admit. And I've missed quite a few things in my absence. Let me explain: being named the best new podcast at the Irish Podcast Awards, the 100th episode of the show, and many more episodes since from my wonderful colleagues. I have to say my favourite was the one on nominative determinism from Emma Tyrrell. I'm not going to tell you what that is, but give it a listen back if you didn't catch it. But look, I suppose it's time to stop stalling. Where have I been for the last few months? I've had to tell this to quite a few people at this stage, and despite that, I still haven't come up with a way of saying it that isn't just extremely blunt. But I have had cancer. And it still feels really weird and a little bit scary to say that out loud. It feels a bit more real maybe when I say it like that. So the last few months, they've just been this whirlwind of surgery and chemotherapy and recovery and scans and stress and, well, just quite a lot to deal with. And you can imagine, as a 30-year-old man, getting cancer was quite a shock. It's testicular cancer that I've been fighting, and I thought, like I think a lot of young men do, that it was an old person's disease. You know, quite aside from that general, oh, I don't need to go to the doctor, I'm grand attitude that we can have quite a lot in our 20s, that sort of indestructible young man thing that we have in our heads. I just never thought for a single second that I would get cancer. Which is totally illogical when you actually think about it and you look at the numbers at the HSE, say 1 in 2 people will get cancer in their lifetime. You still never think it's going to be you. Of course, it's going to be the guy next to you or the guy on the other side or someone else. It's just not ever going to be you. And that doesn't change with age. I met people in hospital in their 60s, their 70s and their 80s who were still absolutely shocked that they got a diagnosis. So I was even more shocked to find out that at 30 years old, I am slap bang in the middle of the highest risk group for testicular cancer. So in this episode, I'm going to talk a bit about my journey that I've been on, but also about testicular cancer itself with some of the experts treating it, because I had no idea I was at risk. My close friends, they had no idea that they are at risk. And if nothing else comes of this, then one person catches their cancer a little bit sooner because they know what to look for, it'll be worth it. So with that in mind, what exactly is testicular cancer?
My full name is Mohammed Saab. I go by Mo. I'm senior lecturer and I am director of the PhD program or director of graduate studies. But Mo will do.
Professor Mo works at UCC and ran a virtual reality program with the GAA to raise awareness about testicular cancer.
So testicular cancer is, as the name indicates, it's a tumor in the testicle that is malignant. It often affects one testicle as opposed to both, but it can affect both testicles as well. There are a lot of types. The vast majority are curable. Even the ones that are not very curable have a high cure rate as well. So it's a very curable disease.
And that was the first thing that I learned about my own cancer. I found it because I had a pain, and initially I didn't think much of it. I thought, I've knocked myself off of something, it's no big deal, it'll go away in a couple of days. And then it didn't. And after about 2 weeks of on and off pain, I thought, oh, maybe I should go to the doctor here. The GP thought it was a thing called epididymitis, which is basically an infection or inflammation at the back of the testicle. So she put me on antibiotics, but booked an ultrasound just in case. And at this stage, I thought that was right, because it wasn't a lump. It didn't feel like a lump. It felt like maybe a little ridge at the back of the testicle, and that was a little harder than the other one. But it wasn't something that I thought, oh, definitively, this is going to be cancer. And then the antibiotics worked. The pain largely went away. It still felt inflamed, but not that bad. I went off to New York for work, covering the UN, put it totally out of my mind, thought I was totally fine. The scan came up and I was actually nearly not going to go, so much had I improved in the couple of weeks, but I said I would just to be safe. genuinely thought nothing was wrong. My fiance Jill asked, would she come with me? And I said, no, absolutely no need. I'll see you for lunch later. Went into the scan anyway, told the story to the person doing it, and I was lying there actually thinking, oh, wonder what I'll have for lunch of all things, when she finished up and said, well, it's not epididymitis. And what she said really only left one outcome. And you know in a film, when a character has something shocking and sudden happen to them and they freeze like a deer in headlights and the world is spinning around them, I thought that was all just something from the movies, but that's exactly what happened. I stood up, couldn't hear anything that anyone was saying to me. I was completely dizzy, just in total shock. And I went out to the waiting room. The first thing I did was Google testicular cancer survival rates, because for the first time ever, I thought, Jesus, am I going to die here? And thankfully, the first result highlighted statistics from the US where there's a 99% 5-year survival rate for cancer that hasn't spread beyond the testicle, and a slightly lower but similar rate, about 95%, for men who've had chemotherapy. In my relief at the time, it was only much later that I wondered, why are we so much better at treating testicular cancers than other cancers?
The full kind of reason for that is unknown. One of them, however, is that it tends to be detected early. Basically, it's a single identifiable symptom, often either pain or lump or swelling. Usually lump is the main one. So it tends to tell us it's there earlier on in the disease. When you compare it to something like lung cancer with very vague symptoms like a cough that you can get from a cold or smoking, for example, they're quite vague. So one of the reasons is it's often detected early.
In some ways, I was lucky. I had pain, which alerted me to the problem pretty early. Others, though, don't have that pain to alert them. And other than that, I felt totally fine. Like, I expected if you had cancer, you would know about it. But that's part of how sinister it is. Had I not had that to alert me, I would have thought I was totally fine. Maybe a bit more tired than usual, but I just put that down to being busy. So if it can creep in like that, almost unnoticed, what should young men be looking out for as risk factors?
You see, some are well known and others are quite vague and there's very little scientific evidence. Age is one, so people below the age of 50. If you're looking at Irish statistics, which are very similar to worldwide or global statistics, the median age is 33. And it is the most common solid tumor in this age group. So age is one, ethnicity is another. White males are at higher risk. And there's another well-established one is undescended testicles. And there's family history as well. So if somebody has a father, a brother, a first-degree relative really with testicular cancer, their risk is higher. There's others as well. There's twinning and there's height and there's all that. But there's very little evidence on them. But these are the established ones. The age, the ethnicity, undescended testicles.
And with height, if you're taller or you're shorter?
Taller men are at higher risk.
So it's good news and bad news. You can get cancer without any of the traditional markers. Certainly, I didn't have many of them. Don't smoke, only a social drinker at the time. Had a pretty good diet, no family history that I know of. So I just joke now, it was my bad luck birthday present. Welcome to your 30s, you've got cancer. The good news is there is a cure for this type.
You know, it's a highly curative diagnosis when it's picked up early.
This is Professor Jack Gleason, a consultant medical oncologist at Cork University Hospital.
And the earlier these are found, the easier they are to treat, the better, you know, the outcomes, the better people respond. So we really don't want men to be hiding this or avoiding coming into a hospital. Our discussions on chemotherapy and things like that can be quite scary, you know, if that's what you think that might be coming down the line. But if these are caught sooner or before the fact that, you know, before a stage where chemotherapy is needed, that's ultimately much better for the men.
It was Friday, 6th of October, 2023, when we got the formal diagnosis. Certainly a day I'll never forget. And sitting in the waiting room at St. Vincent's Hospital that morning, it was probably the closest I've ever come to having a panic attack. Everything just hit me, even though we had a good idea of what to expect and my breathing was really erratic, and it just was this panic was just coursing through my veins. I felt like I couldn't sit still, that it was just thumping at me, even though we generally knew what was going to be said. And I think my consultant urologist expected the five words to hit us harder. He said, "I'm sorry, it is cancer." But to be honest, myself and Jill had resigned ourselves to that fact for the week leading up to the appointment and just wanted to get on to, well, how do we get rid of it? That also happened to be the night of the IMRO Radio Awards in Kilkenny, the Oscars of radio, and we drove down together with me knowing it would be the last time I'd see my work friends and colleagues for a while, and potentially quite a long while. I didn't tell anyone about it. I just wanted to enjoy the last social occasion I'd be at for quite a bit. But as the night wore on, the dissonance between the news that I'd had and the celebration that is the IMROs every year, I just couldn't take it, and I snuck out early, actually not long before Newstalk won Station of the Year, as it happened. And the drive kind of passed me by as I thought about and we discussed the plan for the weeks ahead. The first thing to do was sperm banking, something which is recommended for anyone about to have treatment for testicular cancer, and something which is actually free for cancer patients in Ireland. Most times your fertility will return to normal in time, but there's always a chance that it won't. And then about 10 days later, it was time for surgery, what's called an orchidectomy, which meant effectively losing the offending testicle. A slightly strange experience for any man, all things considered.
Long term, it doesn't impact on things like testosterone levels. It doesn't impact on things like, or significantly impact on things like fertility. It doesn't impact on, you know, our appearance or our manliness or any of those things that people might be worried about with the loss of one testicle. You know, there are prostheses and things that can be put in if people are worried about the appearance. There are no major significant long-term issues. You know, sperm production in the other testes tends to increase over time to compensate, and, you know, men have good chances of achieving children in the future despite having a testicle removed.
As my urologist Dermot Moran said, this isn't exactly a common type of cancer, but nor is it extremely rare. There's about 170 to 180 cases in Ireland every year, but the surgery is pretty straightforward. In fact, from the moment they put the mask on me to put me asleep and told me to count as high as I could, I think I made it to 3 before passing out, to the moment I was wheeled out of the operating room, only about 15 minutes went by. And I woke up groggy and rather happy from some lovely little painkillers about an hour later. Other than a scar on the groin and a bit more than a week of moving rather gingerly about the place, the surgery was a big success. The anxious wait, though, was for the results of a CT scan to see whether or not the cancer had spread. And unfortunately, when Mr. Moran made the call, it wasn't good news. There was another tumour in one of my lymph nodes, which meant chemotherapy. And I'd said all along, I wasn't afraid of the surgery. I'm not even sure I was particularly afraid of the cancer at that stage. It probably hadn't really even computed in my head that it was actually there. But I was afraid of chemo. I mean, how couldn't you be? Most of us have had an experience through a family member or a loved one or a friend, and we've seen what it can do to people.
Unfortunately, you know, as a doctor who gives chemotherapy, a lot of the time we're temporarily making our patients quite a bit more sick, you know, as opposed to a lot of other doctors, and to make their patients maybe feel better.
This is Professor Maeve Lowry, a medical oncologist at St. James's Hospital and Professor of Translational Cancer Medicine at Trinity College. She explained to me how chemotherapy actually works.
Chemotherapy just kills fast-growing cells. And if you think about what a cancer cell is, a cell that's growing really fast, well, it's not a bad tactic, you know, to apply chemotherapy that kills, if you like, or targets fast-growing cells preferentially to normal cells as a strategy. And that's just the basic, I suppose, rationale behind what cytotoxic chemo or traditional chemotherapy drugs do. Essentially, they damage the cell's ability to grow fast. They slow down the ability of the cancer cells to replicate their DNA or to make copies of themselves so that they can grow faster and more quickly.
It was decided I'd move from Vincent's to the Beacon to get the chemo started faster, and about a month after the surgery, I was in for day one. By that stage, there was a second tumour, showing just how fast cancer can move. It was incredibly intimidating heading in to that cancer day unit for the first time. And don't get me wrong, the staff in the Beacon were amazing. They really tried to make a scary experience as comfortable as possible. But before you start, a nurse has to run through all the potential side effects. And I genuinely thought that meeting might never end as she ran through the list. A drop in platelets, breathlessness, lung damage, blood clots, tinnitus, cognitive dysfunction, diarrhea, constipation, weight loss, nausea, sickness, hair loss, kidney damage, liver damage, nerve damage, joint pain, loss of fertility, rashes, dryness, weakness, and so on. Karen Fitzmaurice is a nurse with the Irish Cancer Society's Daffodil Centres and says many patients find the start of chemo pretty tough.
The traditional chemotherapy, you know, most of them are quite harsh. And, you know, the testicular cancer is quite harsh regime because, you know, you're having treatment kind of Monday to Friday and then you have your 2 weeks off. That's the normal regime. So it is quite difficult. But anybody undergoing chemotherapy, it's very individualized. You could have two people on the same treatment side by side and they could have completely different side effects. And I'm sure, you know, your heart stops when you get that list of drugs and all of the side effects. It's like taking out a leaflet in a paracetamol box. Like if you were to read all of that, you'd never take paracetamol. But we all do take paracetamol. So I suppose they're kind of a guide of what to watch out for if you have side effects. But, you know, some people could have completely different side effects to another person sitting beside them, you know.
As Karen mentioned, the regime I was on was three cycles, each of which was 3 weeks long and each of which had three different drugs, 3-3-3s. Week one of each cycle was what I came to call the hard week, 5 days straight of chemo, during which you stayed in hospital for the week so they could keep an eye on you. Then in weeks two and threes, you had just 1 day of treatment on a Monday. And those long weeks were hard. I mean, there's no two ways about it. They were not fun. You were sent over to the day unit where the treatment is given about 9 or 10 in the morning, and you stayed there having the treatment or other IV drips into you until 5 or 6 at in the evening and then back over to the ward. And I didn't sleep well in the hospital those weeks either, a combination of worry, I suppose, being woken in the night to have your vitals checked and just being a light sleeper in general. And because of cannulas, bloody cannulas. I had never heard of them before my treatment. And they came to take on a lot of the frustration I had during it. They're basically these little plastic tubes inserted into a vein to take bloods, or in my case, to administer treatment. But they're fiddly little buggers, and they're often put on the inside of your elbow or in your hand. You have them on the whole time. And if they're knocked about too much, they stop working. So I was always conscious of them when trying to sleep or eat or pee or do just about anything. Bloody cannulas. Anyway, it's funny how in those tough days, you sort of have to make your own fun out of it to distract yourself. I mean, poor Jill worked remotely from the canteen in the hospital most of the time that I was in, just so she could be there each evening when I got back to the ward. And even something as simple as a game of Uno in the evening took your mind off things, even though she still didn't let me win. Or watching movies, I particularly remember, you know, Harry Potter marathon being on TV one of the long weeks. The darts actually provided great distraction, with a member of the cleaning staff chatting about Luke Littler each morning, or swapping book recommendations with a porter. We managed to get out for dinner with my mum one night in the first cycle, and they probably sound like really small things to you listening, but I was just clinging on to any bit of ordinary in a situation that was far from it. It's hard to describe how the chemotherapy felt. It was sort of like having a really bad hangover for 10 or 11 weeks, but I think that makes it sound a bit easier than it was. I mean, one thing I was pleasantly surprised with was how effective the anti-sickness medication was, because I had images, as I'm sure a lot of you have, of being over the toilet bowl 10 times a day. But that wasn't the case at all. Here's Professor Maeve Lowry again.
Well, we have much better drugs. Like, there's just no comparison. So there was a time, and it's correct, in maybe the 80s, you know, the early 90s, and people vomited after chemotherapy, you know, and that was kind of almost expected. And the better drugs have arisen because we understand better how nausea and vomiting arises in people treated with chemotherapy. So essentially, you know, when you give yourself some chemotherapy, it irritates the lining of the stomach and the GI tract, and then signals get sent, like a warning signal, to the vomiting centers within the brain, and then that sends a signal back down to the stomach so to contract and to evacuate what you've just eaten, if you like. But if you can target two or three of those neurotransmitters and stop that signal getting to the brain or the signal getting down to the brain again, then that's really very effective. And so not that we've eliminated, of course, chemo-induced nausea and vomiting, but we've certainly done much better because we understand the mechanism by which it happens. Now, there's some people who are just more prone to nausea. That is, women are more prone to nausea, and people under 50, actually, again, more prone to nausea. But I would say to my patients, you should not vomit. It's not part of getting chemotherapy. And if you do, then we have to change the dose or reduce it to, or add in additional anti-nausea meds.
And that's exactly what happened. By cycle three, I was on an awful lot more anti-sickness medication as the chemo built up in my system and what was working before no longer cut the mustard. Now, that's not to say, you know, there was no sickness at all. It just wasn't on the level that I expected from hearing horror stories in the past, I guess. There were other issues. I mean, the nerve endings in my fingers were damaged. I had tinnitus with my ears ringing. By the final cycle, it was very, very little I felt like eating, although thankfully the weight loss wasn't too bad. It was just a few kilos. One of the drugs, bleomycin, gave me headaches and hallucinations. If it was administered too quickly, I spent one of the first nights rather unpleasantly thinking my head would split open from the pain and that hallucinating that the world was about to end and that it was my fault. But mostly, I was just getting weaker. I mean, one of the drugs was very hard in your lungs. I came back from a short 10-minute walk around our estate one evening, breathing like I'd just run a marathon. The second cycle of treatment ended up being the hardest because halfway through the week of chemo, I started to develop chest pains, which set off all sorts of alarms. But thankfully, two ECGs, a heart echo, a CT scan and an MRI later, they found nothing wrong. They kept the treatment going through this, and it was only later an oncologist told me they'd been taught in med school to always keep going with testicular cancer chemo, no matter the impact on the patient, because the success rate is so high. Professor Jack Gleason explains some of the logic.
For testicular cancer, it's actually been shown that if you alter the chemotherapy regimen, you know, try and lower the dose of one of the drugs or something like that for any risk factor or for anything like that, that you decrease the positive outcomes that you can have after treatment. So it's important to stick with the kind of standardized regimen as much as possible.
The second cycle was also the week I lost my hair. It started with a few hairs on the pillow in the morning, but by the second or third day, I could go into the shower, run my hand over my scalp, and it literally was just all coming away in my hand in big lumps and clumps. On the plus side, if I ever go naturally bald, at least I know my skull isn't a totally weird shape. The complications in cycle two meant staying an extra weekend in hospital that cycle, which is something I found, I think, particularly hard because of the time of year. It was the run into Christmas. And for everyone on the ward, there was just this question of, would you be home for the holidays or not? It probably wasn't helped by the fact that the doorbell for getting access to the cancer ward in the hospital played a very loud and oddly cheery, dissonant version of Dashing Through the Snow whenever anyone pressed it. Thankfully, I did get home for Christmas, and despite everything, we actually made it a really lovely one. I mean, at that point, I was a thing called neutropenic, which means that the neutrophils and white blood cells in my blood were in very, very short supply. And was I to get an infection, I'd have been in quite a bit of bother. My body just wouldn't have been able to fight it. So we returned to COVID-19 protocols, and Christmas Day was just myself, Jill, and our dog, Sammy. And I'd actually say it was one of my favourite Christmases. I know there's a whole load of reasons it shouldn't be, but we just suited ourselves and had this lovely, cosy oasis of a day in the middle of a life storm. We were told at the start of treatment specifically it was going to be a crap Christmas, but you know what? We made it our own. And then we somewhat limped through the last cycle, but buoyed on by the notion at least that the end was in sight. The mental relief of knowing there'd be no more poison pumped into me for a while was only slightly dampened by a call back to get a blood transfusion after a test showed I was now anemic, which at least explained the headaches whenever I would climb the stairs. And now we just had the big question. Had it worked? And unfortunately, listener, I'm still learning there's not always as definitive an all-clear result as you'd like. The first scan showed almost no sign of the disease, with two tiny dots on the picture where the tumours had been. The second scan showed they were gone, but something else in a lung, which is most likely an infection but should still be checked out. And as I record this, I'm waiting on what will hopefully be the final scan for a while. After that, it moves to tests every 6 months and then every year until 5 years has successfully passed cancer-free. But I don't think I'm ever going to go into one of them with any great sense of confidence, always a little bit fearful that it will come back. And for me, you know, that element of fear and anxiousness only really surfaced when the treatment was over. I think during it, you had a very clear fight and a clear plan. And then once the physical issues died off, it was the mental ones that started. Something that nurse Karen Fitzmaurice says isn't all that uncommon.
It feels as if life is on hold. And sometimes it's just afterwards, then it just all builds up. And you kind of think, what have I been through? Like, because you've just been on a roller coaster. You're going in, there's nurses meet you, they tell you what to do. You just go with the plan, you do what you're told. So your life is kind of taken away from you. You're not making decisions yourself. Everybody else is making decisions for you and you're just going with the flow. And then when you're finished treatment, they say, oh, goodbye now, we'll see you in 3 months. And then you're back to making your own decisions. And, you know, you're kind of saying, what do I do now? Because you're so used to the nurses being there, even though they are there in the background, they're there kind of organizing your follow-up scan, your follow-up appointments. It's just then that you have to start taking responsibility for your follow-up care and your follow-up appointments, getting back to, well, what they call is your new normal, because life can't go back to the way it was because you've had a life-changing experience. But sometimes you might find that it makes you a stronger person.
Finding that new normal is something that's definitely still a work in progress. I mean, we've changed pretty much everything about our lifestyle, from diet to dish soap, trying to cut out chemicals and harmful toxins and eating more plant-based, following the science to reduce the risk of recurrence or getting another cancer down the line. I had been vegan years ago, but drifted away from it, largely because cheese is delicious. But I'm firmly back on the vegan bandwagon now. And there are still symptoms of the chemo I'm working to overcome, mainly brain fog, joint pain and fatigue. And in some ways you can feel down about it. I mean, I'm never going to be who I was again. There will always be a before cancer and after cancer part of my life. But at the same time, if you're going to have a health scare and have something open your eyes to how precious life actually is, 30's not a bad time for it to happen, when I'm strong enough to fight it off and hopefully have a long life ahead, which I'm trying to appreciate more. And the message to young men like me who may be at risk and not know it, check yourself. Here's Professor Mo again.
So start today. Feel them in the shower or bath. This is the best place to feel them because the skin is the most relaxed. They're very unique to us. So it's important to know what is normal for me, for you, etc. And then if there's something that is wrong with them, at least I know how at baseline my testicles feel, because some people just don't touch down there. You know, it's just besides showering and doing other stuff. But for purposefully examining testicles, for the sake of examining them, people don't do it much, but at least have a baseline and know how they normally look and feel it.
So that's where I've been the past few months and why I haven't been on podcast duties. I do need to say some thank yous before I go. Firstly, thanks to all the experts who appeared in the podcast today and to the Irish Cancer Society, in particular Fiona Keevely, for facilitating interviews. Thanks to Greystone's Cancer Support, in particular for the yoga. I'd like to thank everyone involved in my treatment, from Dermot Moore and Alana and his team in St. Vincent's, to Ray McDermott, Deirdre, Sally and the team in The Beacon. Thank you to all the nurses and staff in 6th Ward North, in particularly Grace and May, who took great care of me when I was feeling particularly crap.
A special thank you as well to all of the nurses and the healthcare team in the oncology day unit at the Beacon. I mean, they're literally doing life-saving work every day, and they do so with a positive, empathetic and professional approach. They genuinely couldn't have done more, and there are too many to name. They all know who they are, but particular thanks to Maggie, Aaron, Kate, Amy, Sharon, Noelle and Sheena, of course, the cannula queen. Thank you to everyone at Bauer and News Talk for their support, in particular John Keogh, Patricia Monaghan and Chris Doyle, who had my back all the way. Thanks to my family and friends for their support, in particular my poor and long-suffering mum, who was very amazing in difficult times and had to go through that awful thing of having a child have cancer. It wasn't easy for her either. But the biggest thank you has to go to my fiancée, Jill. She genuinely could qualify for a medical degree at this stage. She had the research done on every drug, every possible outcome, every likely treatment option, every doctor and consultant we were going to meet. She had anti-cancer meal plans ready to go, minded me when I was sick, lifted me up when I was down, and gave me the odd kick in the backside when that was needed as well. And I genuinely wouldn't have gotten through without you, Jill. Can't wait to marry you, even if that's been delayed too by this little misadventure. I should probably thank our dog Sammy too, I suppose, who kept me company through many hours of Netflix on the couch, though I suspect he rather enjoyed the extra company. I'll be phasing back into work over the next while, so expect to hear me on the podcast more regularly. Thank you to Lachlan Hart on sound and to series editor John Keogh, and I'll chat to you soon.